The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the 363rd day of the year, the pre-Erev New Year's Eve edition of Dave's Gone By, an hour of talk radio, comedy, music, and whatnot, coming to you live from the snow-capped Merrick, Long Island. It's our lucky 13th show, a farewell to 2002, and good riddance. I'm Dave, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, critic, playwright, journalist, and public speaker, speaking to you this week about everything from airport security to sodomy laws to the best and the worst of the year in theater, plus a chat with an old friend and music from the Counting Crows, Spike Jones, and a tribute to the late Joe Strummer. All that and more on this week's edition of Dave's Gone By, which, I caution, is not a show for children. There's nothing here that's obscene or offensive by community standards. Well, I live in a community of perverts, but if your neighborhood is a little more prim, you might want to keep the smelling salts handy. Everyone else, welcome to Dave's Gone By, which we begin with the news gone by right after this message. Start spreading the news. There's a new magazine in town with the latest stories and reviews about everything on stage. On and Off Magazine is a glossy, full-color guide to theater, dance, comedy, and cabaret in New York City. The best part is, it's free. You can find On and Off around town at theaters, restaurants, hotels, and community and information centers. Visit www.onandoffstage.com for more information, and let On and Off be your guide. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's time for the news gone by, a look at events of the past week from an animated perspective. In international news, tensions increased between the United States and our latest dire enemy, North Korea. Our nemesis from 50 years ago has been popping fresh fuel rods into its nuclear reactors and then removing United Nations monitoring equipment from the area. In logic that would make Professor Irwin Corey scratch his head, the North Koreans say they're stepping up their ability to make nuclear war as a way of forcing the U.S. to avert nuclear war. Figure that one out. According to the Associated Press, the Koreans signed a treaty in 1994 promising to freeze nuclear development in exchange for oil from the U.S. Well, they kept their promise, only they apparently started a different weapons program using uranium. The U.S. cut off their oil shipments. So, North Korea says we reneged on the contract, and they started up the nuke plant again. Just to show that all the Koreans really want is peace and serenity, Defense Minister Kim Il-chol said in a statement, quote, "If the U.S., ignorant of their rival, dare provoke a nuclear war, the army and the people of North Korea, led by Kim Jong-il, the invincible commander, will rise up to mete out determined and merciless punishment to the U.S. imperialist aggressors." He's a sweetheart, isn't he? Makes you feel all warm and toasty inside. Fearing nuclear escalation, last week the U.N. sent over a number of watchdogs, which the Koreans promptly ate. In legal news, Ellen Morfonius, a Miami judge known for her idiosyncrasies and harshness, died at age 73 of stomach cancer. Morfonius was given the nickname Maximum because she was known for throwing the book at defendants, sometimes indiscriminately. For example, according to the Associated Press, the judge once made a robber who urinated on the courtroom floor leave the room without his pants, and then she sentenced him to 1,197 years in prison. Another time, when a defendant passed out on the floor, she went right to the next case and asked the next defendant to step over the body. But what will really add to her time in hell is that before she became a judge, Morfonius was the prosecutor at the famous obscenity trial for Jim Morrison. He was convicted of indecent exposure and using profanity, though surprisingly acquitted of public drunkenness as well as lewdness. I guess juries back then were as stupid as the lawyers. I do have some sympathy for Maximum Morfonius, She had a talk radio show where she went by the moniker of Lady Ellen, and she had a pet chimpanzee, Toto, that she'd sometimes bring to work. Now, I have very mixed feelings about the death penalty. I do believe some crimes deserve capital punishment, while at the same time, I'm convinced that there are too many flaws in the system to be 100% sure when you pull the lever. Still, I think God showed mercy when he sentenced Morphonius to death. Well, mercy to the rest of us, anyway. Though if St. Peter tells her to plead not guilty by reason of insanity, I'd believe that too. The best news of all is that from now until eternity, we have the right for her to remain silent. In geographic news, nearly 250 people bid on eBay to buy a small town, Bridgeville, California. The winning bid was $1.8 million for the rundown property 260 miles north of San Francisco. Bidding started at $775,000 for the 82-acre town, which has its own post office and features a mile and a half of riverbank. Previous owner Liz Lapple told the Associated Press she didn't have the $200,000 she needed to fix the town up, so she put it on the market via eBay, where she got her asking price and then some. It's assumed the place sold so well because the right buyer could turn it into a small retreat or resort. Also, the owner would literally have his own zip code, something only talk show personality Star Jones can currently boast. In science news, French scientists from the Clonaid company claim to have delivered the world's first cloned baby. Born healthy at 7 pounds by cesarean section, the baby girl, named Eve, was cloned using cells taken from the mother. Clonaid expects 4 more cloned babies born by the end of January, the same month they expect to do 20 more implantations. Since not a shred of evidence was presented at the press conference announcing the modern miracle, many scientists and journalists remain skeptical. Pardon me. Not helping Clonaid's cause is that the company is run by the Raelians. Now that is a religious sect who believe extraterrestrial scientists populated the Earth via cloning. More specifically, the Raelian movement was founded in France when an extraterrestrial contacted a race car driver named Claude Borignon on December 13, 1973. This is, by the way, from the official Raelian website. I am not making this up. The alien, whose name was Yahweh Elohim, dictated a positive message for humanity and asked Claude to ask the world to build an embassy for the aliens to establish a line of mutual communication. This led Claude, new named Rael, to to write the books Let's Welcome Our Fathers from Space and Sensual Meditation. I'm really not kidding about this. Plus, he gives seminars all over the world, and he puts out a quarterly magazine called Apocalypse. The utopian writings of Rael range, from very humanistic anti-war essays and calls for global human rights and sexual openness to more controversial pieces equating the bombing of Hiroshima with terrorism and the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land as another near Holocaust. Well, it's all based on the concept that the Hebrew biblical word for God, Elohim, is actually plural, because the suffix im is always plural in the Hebrew language. So, So, Rael extrapolates all this into a belief that Elohim does not mean a single deity, or even many gods, but the literal translation, those who fell from the sky. Pardon me, just one quick sec, I'm going to need some water. Let's do a station ID. Or station cough. Oh well, we'll just sit and listen to me drinking some water.
M-L-U-G-B-B.
Well, that was quick. We're back. Those who fell from the sky. At first, Rael began worshipping snow. But when the snowflakes simply melted upon contact with the earth, frustration set in. Rael then turned his attention to bird droppings, which worked a lot better but made gaining followers very difficult. Rael's other failed religious experiences included soot, piñatas, and the dangerous encounter with chunks of icy urine falling from a TWA. As for baby Eve, the Raelians have promised proof of her existence in 8 days. I have heard that she's healthy and looks just like her mom, although every time a cellular phone goes off, she cries, Daddy. In other procreative news, the Supreme Court is currently considering whether states can punish homosexuals for having sex. It's a constitutionality test for sodomy laws that remain on the books in 13 states. Back in 1986, still smack dab in the Reagan years, the court ruled 5-4 that consenting adults of the same gender have no constitutional right to have sex. In public, in private, in a hotel, it doesn't matter. Gay sex is illegal wherever the sodomy law is applicable. What is sodomy? The court defines it as, quote, abnormal sex. What's abnormal? Depending on what U.S. state you're in, it could mean penetration by an object, it could mean simple anal sex, it could just mean oral sex. That's the basic, incredibly unclear legal definition of sodomy. It's not about rape, it's not about forcing someone to do anal, it's not about a sicko gouging out some 13-year-old's rectum with a broken bottle. It's just a way of Big Brother telling homosexuals, naughty, naughty, 33 years after Stonewall, 100 years after Oscar Wilde. And, as a special side benefit, it's a way of telling women that sex is not for pleasure, but only for procreation and male dominance. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper, 9 states ban consensual sodomy for everyone, that's gay and straight. Alabama, Florida, Idaho, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Utah, and Virginia. That means a married, late middle-aged couple, home watching Letterman in the bedroom of their Miami condo, if the wife decides to give her husband a little head, and I can say that word because Lou Reed said it in Walk on the Wild Side and commercial radio has been playing that song for years, if a little oral sex goes on with the lights down and the shades drawn between husband and wife, they're breaking the law, which is deranged, but understandable considering the fear of sex by so-called moral white Christians in America. The real hypocrisy comes from Texas, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma, where sodomy is fine between heterosexuals. But if two men or two women go down on each other, and I can say the phrase go down on the radio because an old Hebrew spiritual has the phrase go down Moses, if a gay couple do the same things a straight couple does, only the gay couple are breaking the law. These hateful sodomy laws are over 100 years old and almost never enforced, but they were in 1998 when John Geddes Lawrence and Tyron Garner were arrested in Lawrence's apartment and charged with sodomy. They spent the night in a Texas jail and were later fined. The Supreme Court is now reviewing that case, and they'll soon be ruling, not directly on whether having gay sex is illegal, but just on whether states that have sodomy laws can enforce the statutes and punish transgressors. As a straight, white, secular, Jewish, fairly liberal guy, I hope the Supreme Court now comes to its senses, especially before the Bush family packs the place with oil barons and fundamentalists. And, in the interest of justice and freedom, I'm going to give the Supreme Court a little help here. I've come up with a balanced scale of sexual activities and their rewards and or punishments the way they should be under the law. See if you agree with me that this is a much more logical, more fair way of regulating the horizontal mambo, or the vertical cha-cha, or the triangular lambada, than the sodomy laws currently on the books. First of all, rape and murder, life imprisonment, and possibly the death penalty. Violent rape, life imprisonment. Nonviolent, but still non-consensual rape, 20 years of life imprisonment. Or as my engineer says, so it's legal in jail, a state of government facility, but not in one's bedroom. Well, there you go. You just killed a joke that was coming up in about 1 minute. All right, thanks a lot, dude. But anyway, those first three seem pretty sensible, I think, but here's some others. And all of this goes for everyone of all sexes, male, female, transgender, Michael Jackson, everyone. Now we get to acts between mutually willing participants that the government nevertheless considers abnormal. Anal sex. 1 year in prison, but only because prison is the easiest place for adults to find anal sex. See, there was my joke. Thanks, Paul. Oral sex. 2 years in a minimum security gymnasium where cushiony mats will prevent thousands of knee injuries every year. Doggy style, which is sex from the rear but not in the rear. And I can say doggy style on the radio because I own two dogs and they both have style. The doggy style punishment is a year of home incarceration. You can come and go as you please, but you must use the back door. Doggy style with an actual dog, 3 months obedience training. Sex using a hammock or a harness, 6 months suspended. Sex involving food, 6 months being forced to prepare McDonald's big and tasty Happy Meals. Sex involving excrement, an overnight stay at White Castle. Sex involving an enema, 3 months forced labor making Burger King's secret sauce. Performing oral sex on someone who's driving a motor vehicle. 2 years of orthodontia, plus a stern lecture on why you should never talk with your mouth full. Having sex with a hot little 18-year-old who isn't your wife. That's not part of the bit. It's one of my New Year's resolutions. Wrapping a live gerbil in tinfoil and jamming it into your partner's anus. 12 months of running very, very fast on a little wheel. Now, those of you who thought I was going to make a Richard Gere joke, please remember that we did the obvious joke of the week last week, and any Richard Gere insults will have to wait until at least after Easter. And finally, female nymphomania. 18 months probation, plus 25 phone numbers of Democratic congressmen. And that's the news gone by for December 29th, 2002. Send in your comments, opinions, and test tube baby wipes to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062, or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Please, no uranium, unless it really comes from Uranus. Broadway, off-Broadway, cabaret. These are magical words conjuring up a universe of great entertainment. If you want to know everything about what's happening on the stages of New York, you need to get Performing Arts Insider magazine. For 60 years, Performing Arts Insider has been a bible of the industry. It tells you when shows are opening and closing, what they're about, who's in it, designers, writers, composers, contacts for producers and managers, box office info, parental guides, everything you need to know if you care about theater, opera, and dance too. As the chief editor of Backstage put it, Performing Arts Insider is who, what, where, and when, all the facts at your fingertips. For more information, how to subscribe or get a sample issue, call 516-295-1511 or go to www.totaltheater.com and click on Performing Arts Insider. Back to Dave's Gone By. It's 8:20 p.m., Sunday before New Year's. Now, this show is produced by Total Theater. That's the parent company, and they have a website, TotalTheater.com, and they put out a theater magazine, Performing Arts Insider, which you just heard about. Now, since it's the end of the annum, it's the time for Performing Arts Insider, of which I am the editor-in-chief, to choose its best and worst Broadway and off-Broadway shows of the past 12 months. It's in the January 1st issue of the magazine, on sale now, and it'll be our segment of Dave's Gone Cultural this week, where we'll run down the top 10 and bottom 10 theatrical offerings of 2002. It's a completely subjective list. Basically, the criteria was that the best shows took chances, maybe they were a little complex or quirky, but they ultimately worked. The bad shows were boring, simple as that. Or some of the musicals were too aggressively in your face or patronizing. So here's the tops and flops of the past year. Have your pencils ready, because some of the best shows are still running, and I urge you to get tickets for them. Counting up from 10, a la Letterman, number 10, Swimming with Watermelons, a zany and endearing musical that was at the Vineyard Theater. Number 9, Fortune's Fool, with Frank Langella, Alan Bates, and a great script by, well, Ivan Turgenev. Number 8, Amour, a charming but short-lived musical by Michel Legrand. Number 7, Hairspray, with nutty gags and a Harvey Fierstein in a house dress. Need I say more? And that one is still playing at the Neil Simon Theater. Number 6, Thoroughly Modern Millie at the Marquee Theater. Winner of last year's Tony Award, it's goofy fun, and it also is still playing. Número 5, last season's Broadway revival of Mornings at 7. Number 4, Three Dark Tales, a wonderful, mostly mime piece by the European troupe Theater O. And okay, here's the top 3 of 2002. The Dazzle, a very textured and touching play by one of the best playwrights around, Richard Greenberg. His newest, by the way, Take Me Out, is moving from off-Broadway to Broadway in a couple of weeks. In second place, another fine playwright, Lanford Wilson, not for the tepid revival of Burn This, but for his new play, Book of Days, a look at small-town hypocrisy that was beautifully observed. Topping the list, best of the best, Alain Strachey's Liberty. Yes, that show technically started in 2001, but that was off-Broadway at the Public Theater. It moved to Broadway this year and was thrilling and engaging and everything you could want from a one-woman show and more. I'll drink to that. And now, because no silver lining exists without a cloud, Performing Arts Insider also brings you the worst of 2002, the 10 shows most likely to leave you mangling your ticket stub in agony. Starting with number 10 and working our way down, An Almost Holy Picture, a one-man show about faith that starred Kevin Bacon and tested the faith of almost everyone watching. Number 9, Menopause the Musical. There's a few laughs in this musical review that really appeals to its target audience, but the humor is one-note and repetitious. Number 8, the boring Broadway revival of The Elephant Man. Number 7, B. Arthur on Broadway. As great as Alain Stritch was, that's how disappointing B was. I don't even want her baby anymore. Number 6, Surviving Grace, a silly sitcom about Alzheimer's. Oh yeah. Número 5, What a Stinko, the drama Sorrows and Rejoicings. Athol Fugard is a great, great playwright. They'll be reviving Master Harold and the Boys on Broadway this spring, but his talky new play gave audiences much more sorrow than rejoicing. Number 4, speaking of dull and prolix, the latest from Horton Foote, The Carpetbagger's Children, should have been tagged and bagged. And now the bottom of the barrel, the worst three shows of 2002. Number 3, Vienna Lusthaus, a revival of Martha Clark's dance drama that proved you can have attractive women posing naked for 90 minutes and still be unbelievably monotonous. If porn was this boring, Al Goldstein would be selling pretzels on 35th Street. Number 2, and it certainly is, The Goat, or Who is Sylvia? Enric Albee may be the most overrated playwright in the universe at this point, and giving the Tony Award to this incredibly puerile, pointless piece of pseudo-provocation rankles me to this day. I mean, The Goat was better than the play about the baby, but what is this magnetism Albee has that makes perfectly rational critics think he's profound? Finally, the first of the worst, the most brutal bore of 2002, Brutal Imagination. It was an off-Broadway show where the playwrights had one of those what-if ideas. Hey, what if Susan Smith, the real-life woman who drove her kids into the ocean and then blamed it on an imaginary black kidnapper, what if she really believed in the black guy she was blaming for the drowning? That was the show, him and her going back and forth about reality, fantasy, race, and history. And if that sounds interesting, trust me, you weren't there. Lucky you. To read more about all these shows, good and bad, plus every other show currently on and off Broadway, you can subscribe to Performing Arts Insider either monthly or 21 times a year. Just call 516-295-1511 for more information, or check the TotalTheater.com website and click on the link for Performing Arts Insider. Back after this. Every Saturday night at 7:30, right here on WGBB, it's Joe Salzone Live. Tell us about it, Joe.
Well, Dave, it's a half-hour, fast-paced glimpse at the world we live in.
Joe Salzone brings his old-fashioned, conservative views, along with his desire to hear all viewpoints, to the airwaves each week. It's a one-of-a-kind show that you'll hear only on Long Island's news and information leader,
1240 AM WGBB,
the station that serves your community. Welcome back. Two Dave's Gone By, it's 8:27 p.m. Sunday night. Time for a little remembrance, a little tribute. Last Sunday, December 22nd, Joe Strummer, lead singer and co-guitarist, co-songwriter for The Clash, died of a heart attack at his home in Somerset, England. He was only 50 years old, with a wife and two kids, plus a stepdaughter. Strummer had stayed quite active in music long after The Clash broke up, with his own band, The Mescaleros, as well as with special projects. Most recently, he was working with Dave Stewart and Bono on a song about AIDS awareness. Born in Ankara, Turkey, as John Graham Miller, son of an English diplomat, Strummer dropped out of art school to be part of the bar band and busker scene. Then he saw the Sex Pistols and realized punk was where he wanted to be. In 1977, The Clash was born. Joe Strummer and guitarist Mick Jones were the heart of the band, who were angry and cynical like the Sex Pistols, but more intelligent, moral, and idealistic. A lot of critics thought the Clash were one of the best rock bands ever. I wouldn't go that far, maybe because I never saw them live. I find it hard to listen to more than a few Clash songs at one time. A fatigue factor sets in. And by the time their records started to sound better production-wise, like on Combat Rock, the band was already Splitsville. For all the songs they did in the early years that were important to the punk movement, Guns of Brixton, London Calling, Train in Vain, I have to say it was the more slick, commercial stuff towards the end that I prefer to listen to. Rock the Casbah, Straight to Hell, and the absolute indisputable rock classic, Should I Stay or Should I Go? But tonight, we'll go back to an earlier album, London Calling, for this Mick Jones, Joe Strummer tune. It's called Death or Glory, and unlike the very adamant, sloganistic title, Death or Glory, it's a very wise, perceptive song about human nature. Now, Strummer and Jones were writing this in 1979, for an album whose cover photo shows a band member about to pulverize a guitar. So, they were still in the forefront of angry young punks. But already, they could see that anarchy and guitar smashing only go so far when you reach the other side of 25. Death or Glory knows that for most people, the choice isn't so black and white as Neil Young's Better to Burn Out than Fade Away. At the same time, we don't all turn into characters in snide Randy Newman songs about bourgeois middle-class sellouts. The truth of what happens to your patterns of life, your beliefs, when you get older, is a lot more nebulous. So tonight, we'll remember Joe Strummer for his music, his anger, his smarts, his persistence, and wish he got a little older. The song is Death or Glory, and it's almost impossible to make out the lyrics on first listen, so I'm just going to read them first, real quick, with one little lyric change because of an obscenity. Death or Glory. Every cheap hood strikes a bargain with the world, and ends up making payments on a sofa or a girl. Love and hate tattooed across the knuckles of his hand, the hands that slap his kids around because they don't understand how death or glory becomes just another story. How death or glory becomes just another story. And every gimmick-hungry yob digging for gold from rock and roll grabs the mic to tell us he'll die before he's sold. But I believe in this, and it's been tested by research, that he who blasphemes nuns will later join the church. Death or glory becomes just another story. From every dingy basement on every dingy street, I hear every dragging hand clap over every dragging beat. That's just the beat of time. The beat that must go on. If you've been trying for years, then we've already heard your song. Death or Glory becomes just another story. We're going to march a long way. We're going to travel a long time. We're going to travel over mountains. We're going to travel overseas. We're going to fight you, brother. We're going to fight you till you lose. We're going to raise trouble. We're going to raise hell. Death or Glory becomes just another story. Death or Glory becomes just another story. Joe Strummer. Gone at the age of 50. Death, but some glory left behind.
Thank you.
you're a big fan of Dave's Gone By, and I know I am, why not join the Bystanders, the official Dave's Gone By fan club? Because you can receive a bi-monthly newsletter, get a weekly special email, an autographed membership card, eligible for discounts on show merchandise and local businesses, receive a one-hour best-of audio tape, including favorite moments from the show, and maybe even stuff we couldn't put on the radio. All this for just $10. For the newsletter, the discounts, the email, and the collector's item audio tape, it's a great deal. And if you join before March 31st, we'll throw in a signed picture of the host. Just make a $10 check or money order payable to Total Theater and send it to Total Theater, Box 62, that's 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. You can also join via PayPal to the email address davesgoneby@aol.com. That's davesgoneby@aol.com. Hi, and welcome back to Dave's Gone By. And this is a segment, relatively new segment, we call Dave Gets Personal. Haven't done very much of that so far, where it's been a lot of comedy and political and news talk. But I guess the listeners should know a bit more about me and where I come from. So one way of doing that is getting to know some of the people in my life and my friends and people I know. And this is a fella I've known for a bunch of years. His name is JP. And I want to welcome him to GBB. Hello, JP.
Oh, good. Good evening.
Well, thank you very much. And it happens to be in the middle of the afternoon when we're taping this, but the public doesn't have to know that. Thank you. Well done. Anyway, I've known JP. He's actually a friend of a friend initially. Why don't you say how first the connection was made?
Oh, yeah. Our mutual buddy, Scott. I happened to see Scott one night in my synagogue, and back in probably, I'd say, the late 1970s, and I had seen that he was wearing a jean jacket with the Andy Warhol's banana painted on the back, and that was the back cover of the first Velvet Underground album. And I asked him, I was kind of surprised that a guy in high school back then would be wearing it, so we got to be talking, and lo and behold, we got to be friends, and then I met this character over here.
That's me, yeah. And it's been fun to know. I've actually known you better over the past couple of years than I did in the way back of the late 70s. And one of the things that interests me most about you is just the wild and crazy career path that you've had since I've known you. Some of the things that you can talk about include...
Well, I was trained to wash dishes and pots by the best Bowery bums in the business.
Oh, this is interesting. How did that come about, actually?
Well, you know, I used to work for this catering hall, and you know, back then when the Bowery was still mostly Alkies, we'd round them up. There'd be these employment agencies, and you round up the Alkies, and it was good because you got the Alkies would come down from the Bowery, and they'd get hot meals, and they'd get a cot. And they get paid, and they'd wash dishes and mop the floors. So I was trained to wash dishes. I was one of the busboys and doormen at one of the catering halls. So, always a bunch of good guys.
Well, what's the best tip that one of the alcoholics gave you as far as how to wash a dish purely and pristinely?
Hot water.
Well, beats urine. Which was the one of choice before that.
That's true, but they said that if you're going to clear off the plates, just remember when you're throwing the gherkins back into the big vat that don't throw the half-eaten gherkins in.
Oh no, they reused pickles?
Oh, we had pickles reused. I'd say maybe 2 years or so.
Oh God! What else did you what other food recycled itself?
Oh, mostly just the appetizers, like the gherkins and the olives and things like that.
Well, the things that were already green, so you couldn't tell if they were turning, I guess.
That must be it. Yeah, I'd say so.
So okay, so that's one extremely interesting career path. What led further after that? What else have you you've been doing?
Oh, let's see. Used to transport cars and trucks around the country, and got to see a lot of lot of this the lower 48, mm-hmm. and didn't make any money at it, but because we spent it along the way buying junk here and there and filling up our place with lots of junk. But as I said, you get to see a lot of the country.
What was your favorite? What's your favorite in the lower 48? Favorite state?
Zanesville, Ohio.
Good heavens. That's not a state, but it's part of a state. What was so wonderful about Zanesville, Ohio?
Oh, you go into Tom's Ice Cream Bowl, which is one of these last of the great ice cream parlors. Not really a parlor in the old sense, but the guys still have their little white paper hats that they wear and little aprons and good typical Midwestern... very rich and fatty ice cream.
Yeah, they actually reuse the nuts. It's kind of interesting. The people that when they leave stuff over, they put the nuts back in the new dishes of ice cream. It's the old fashioned way.
Yeah.
Now, one of the fairly more recent things that you've done had to do with airplanes and stuff, which is kind of interesting, especially now with all the terrorism stuff going on and all the war fears. Tell us a little about all of that.
We used to search planes for narcotics, mainly cocaine and marijuana, and we'd go on before customs would go on, and we'd search the planes. This was a contract that was meted out from the State Department, if I remember correctly, and the U.S. Customs Service.
So let's say I'm an airplane. And you're coming to me to look for whatever might be in me. What are you looking for, or what might the bad guys do? Where would they put stuff?
Oh, well, a lot of times you would have it in the cargo hold areas. There are sometimes you'd take a let's say a package of pot, and you'd wrap it up in brown masking tape, and then you'd put a little string attached to it. Then you'd throw it in one of these, there are these pop-out pressurized panels in the inside the cargo area of the plane that pop out.
It's kind of like an airplane tampon.
Yeah. And then you'd take your little flashlight and look up, and you'd see, lo and behold, this string hanging down with this masking tape and package of whatever, some kind of narcotic. Then also you'd find them in the a lot of times you'd find them stuck up somewhere in the bathroom, sometimes underneath the floors of the airplane, and then sometimes in the where the black box, which is actually red, occasionally you'd find it in the tail area.
But again, it wouldn't be passengers necessarily on that plane bringing it in.
No,
covertly.
No, that would be someone who's working around the plane.
Now, and the thing that really kind of blew my mind is I asked you when we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago how often you would go into planes and find something. And I figured, you know, every few weeks, boom, you come across a little package. But no, what did you?
Well, sometimes you'd have spurts where you wouldn't find anything for a number of days or weeks on end, and then you'd have a spurt where you'd find almost every day. And but sometimes you don't really know whether the plane had traveled X amount of times backwards and forwards from wherever it was. And they were just waiting for the perfect opportunity to then pull the stuff off of the plane. But you know, you could find pretty we would find pretty frequently at certain points.
And did you ever have to appear in court and say I found this or
no?
You were out of the process
at
that point.
No, that's dealt with the Customs Service and whoever was dealing with that, the DEA.
And did you ever use dogs in the search and stuff? Did you have to work with?
No, the dogs, those were the domain of the customs agents, and no dogs for us.
Okay. Well, I want to thank JP for joining me here and just giving me, believe it or not, just a little taste of what his career has been so far. And again, thank you so much for coming into GBB, and hope you can come back, because it was definitely fun chatting.
Thank you.
Hi, folks. Dave Lefkowitz here from Dave's Gone By, and I want to tell you about a product, event, or service. I'm going to talk about it for half a minute or a minute. I'm going to make it really interesting, and all my listeners are going to go, hey, maybe I'll try this product, event, or service. It's called advertising or sponsorship, and it's easy, cost-effective, and just plain effective. To get your person, place, or thing, well, not thing, promoted on Dave's Gone By and reach listeners all over Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island, and the tri-state area, just give us a call at 516-295-1511 or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By, and see sponsorship opportunities, ad rates, and more. Again, the number, 516-295-1511. Insert your product, event, or service here. Welcome back, folks, to Dave's Gone By and a segment called Dave Gets Trivial. Here's a New Year's factoid I didn't know about. I was flipping through the cable dial and started watching a little bit of a romantic comedy called Tortilla Soup. It has Hector Elizondo in it, Elizabeth Peña. Seems like a nice enough movie, even if most critics called it a watered-down remake of Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. But anyway, there's a scene in it with Jacqueline Obradors, the little cutie from NYPD Blue, and she's talking to her boyfriend, and she asks him, "Do you know why we clink glasses when we drink together, when we make a toast?" And he didn't know, so she tells him. And her answer, I didn't know if this was just a clever screenwriter or the actual truth, but a few websites back this up. The reason we clink our glasses when we drink together is, I'll tell you right after I give a plug to Don Lewis, host of Entertainment Long Island. It's an hour of interviews and advice about how to get started as a performer, be it for business or a hobby. Every show has trivia, nostalgia, live music by Eddie Hug and the Moonshiners, and Don's a real pro, he puts on a good show. His show's on tonight at 10, but starting next week, new day and time, Saturdays, 5 to 6 p.m. So give a listen to Entertainment Long Island, 5 p.m. Saturdays on WGBB, because the stage is a world of entertainment. Okay, did you give it some thought, or did you know the answer? The most commonly given reason people clink their glasses when they toast is that drinking is a very sensual, indulgent experience. We use four senses when sipping wine or champagne. We look at the color, we inhale the aroma, we touch the glass delicately, and we hold the beverage in our mouths, and of course we taste it. Sight, smell, touch, and taste. But we want to get all five senses involved in such a pleasurable communal activity, so we add sound, a little clink, for imbibing in sensorround. Well, that's the most common explanation anyway, especially in chick flicks. But according to the Hiller's Market World of Wine website, there are some other explanations that may be more authentic, if a heck of a lot less romantic. The historical explanation of the glass clink apparently had to do with drinkers making sure they weren't being poisoned. A host will offer a guest a beverage. The guest would then pour a little of his own drink into the host's glass, common custom. Then they both drink simultaneously. That way, if one glass had something toxic in it, both drinkers have to suffer. Now, if the guest wanted to make a symbolic gesture that he trusted his host, he knew he wasn't going to be poisoned, instead of pouring a dribble of his wine into the host's glass, he'd simply touch the rim of the glass to that of his host. It's like, hey dude, I trust you, ching ching. The website adds that this theory is backed up by another old custom. You make a toast with your arm extended straight out from the shoulder, which shows the other people in the room that you have no weapons and that everyone comes in peace. There's also a third theory, based on the ancient concept that alcoholic beverages, which we nickname spirits, actually have spirits in them, hence the demon in demon rum, or that mischievous myth, Bacchus. Well, bells, assumedly church bells, and loud noises have long been used to drive off evil spirits. Think of Nosferatu cringing in terror when the sunrise rooster crows. Since these evil sounds fling away naughty ghosts and ghoulies, we clink our glasses to banish the evil spirits from our spirits. Clink and drink. So, that's our little New Year's factoid for Dave Gets Trivial. And this is Spike Jones.
Clink, clink, another drink.
Plenty in the cellar when it's gone.
Drink, drink, the glasses clink.
Making tinkly music till the dawn is breaking.
Clang, clang, who cares a dang?
What's the difference when you're on a spree? Over the teeth, behind the gums, look out, stomach, here she comes.
I have another drink on me. Gurgle, 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 gurgle. Gurgle, 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 gurgle. Trickle, 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 trickle. Slice of cheese and bite of pickle. Doesn't even cost a nickel. Now to wash it down. Whoa!
Clank. Clink. No more to drink. I had a cellar full, but now it's gone. A drink, the glasses clink. Like the anvil chorus in my head is splitting. A breaky, a busty. Oh, brother. Oh, ow. What do I do now? Pink elephants are running after me. Though the stuff was smooth as silk, from now on I'll stick to milk. Nothing else to drink for me.
Mike Jones, circa 1941, clink, clink, another drink. The funny voice on that track, of course, Mel Blanc. And from the heights of bubbly bonhomie, we go to the other side of New Year's, the hangover before it happens. Heaven knows this was a better year than 2001, but it wasn't that good. Still, hope springs eternal, and maybe this year will be better than the last. I'm going to play some Counting Crows for you as soon as we get that queued up. It's from their second album, Recovering the Satellites, a song called A Long December. Certainly kind of was this year. And we're just about to hear the boys of, yeah, CDs queuing slowly. So why don't I say now that for a playlist of Dave's Gone By on this and previous episodes, check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. The site has photos, archival stuff, plus how to advertise, sponsor, join the club. Lots of ways to help out. Here's the Crows.
A long December, and there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than the last. I can't remember the last thing that you said as you were leaving. All the days go by so fast. It's one more day up in the canyon, and it's one more night in Hollywood. If you think that I could be forgiven, I wish you would. Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na should. Na 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 na. After 2 a.m. and talked a little while about the year. I guess the winter makes you laugh a little slower, makes you talk a little lower about the things you could not show her. And it's been a long December. Tried to tell myself to hold on to these moments as they pass, and it's one more day up in the canyon, and it's one more night in Hollywood. So long since I've seen the ocean, I guess I should.
Love that song from the second Counting Crows album, A Long December. Well, I hope your December 29th moved just a little faster this past hour. If you like the program, again, check the website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By, or you can just Google search under the title, and we're right up top. Thank you to station manager Joey, engineer Paul, engineer Joe. Listen to his show, Joe Sells Own Live, Saturday nights at 7:30. Also, Saturday nights, new day and time slot, Don Lewis hosting Entertainment Long Island about how to be a performer. It's 5:30 to 6:30. We had the times wrong before. It's 5:30 to 6:30 Saturday nights. Thanks to my assistant and wife, Joyce Weil. Happy New Year to my mom and dad, my family, my good friends, my colleagues in the theater, and to all of you. Happy birthday, Auntie Essie. My New Year's resolution is to make the show better, more interesting, more adventurous, maybe more spontaneous in the year ahead. I hope you'll resolve to tune in and hear whether I succeed. So that's Dave's Gone By for the end of 2002, and good riddance. Please send your comments, suggestions, and Auld Lang Sign Language to davesgoneby@aol.com. See you next week, next year, where Sundays at 8, please don't be late. Same you, same me, same station, GBB. Don't miss your year going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Good year. And gone by. And I will walk and talk
You've been listening to Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz on 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community.
Sweet thing.